Hello, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, it is working.
All right.
So, hello. So as Wendy said, my name is Michel. First test is whether you can write my name without spelling errors. And I'm going to tell you about one of the sort of set of principles that we want to teach you in this class and that we will going to ask you to play with and experiment with. And so it's called, it's around the notion of instruments. So in my intro class, and I don't know if this has been presented to you before, but I introduced computers that have been used in three different types of ways. One is a computer is a tool, like a hammer, but it can do more things than the hammer. Steve Jobs used to say, you know, the computer is a bicycle for the mind. So a tool empowers you to do things that you wouldn't be able to do without the tool or not so easily. If you try to put a nail in a wall without a hammer, with your bare hands, it's going to hurt, and you probably won't succeed. The second, what we call paradigm, is the notion of the computer as a an agent or a servant. So that's more the realm of AI that tries to make systems that either replace humans by performing things for them or assist humans like a human assistant would do. Right? So we tend to call the first type first-person interface because I'm doing the work, I'm using the tool, and the second type second-person interface because I'm treating the computer as someone I can ask to do things for me. So these are two different, really, conceptions, and it's not that one is better than the other. We happen to work mostly in the first one, although we do things where we try to combine the two. But it's useful to have this distinction. And then there's a third role of computers, which is to mediate interaction and communication among humans. So we all use, from email to social networks to video conferencing, where the computer helps us to communicate with others. So in this class, we're going to mostly stick with tools and instruments, what I call instruments. I like the word instrument because a tool, you know, when I say tool, you think a hammer. If I say instrument, you think violin. And I don't know, it's a bit more exciting to think about, you know, the computer as a violin than the computer as a hammer. What I find interesting in this notion of tool is that it's something that is really that really separates humans from other species. Now, there are there is evidence that that animals, some animals use tools. There are animals that use like wooden sticks to get food out of like honey from a bee hive. There are monkeys who can use a stone to break a coconut to get to the coconut. So yes, there is evidence there, but nobody does it the way humans do it, which is they use tools for everything, and more importantly, they create their own tools. They don't use a piece of wood or stone that's lying around there. They make tools, and they make tools to make tools. So you know this image? Oh, the bus arrived. So this is an image from 2001, Space Odyssey, famous movie. Yes? You've all seen it? No?
It's a classic.
I don't think it's aged that well. The end is intensely boring for me, but anyway, that's the scene at the beginning where this monkey suddenly discovers that he can use this bone as a weapon. And presumably the first uses of objects as tools has been to, you know, fight and defend yourselves and kill other animals. But if we stick to humans, in fact, this is a fairly recent discovery that they found traces of tool making by humans, what you call them, pre-humans, as far back as 3.3 million years. Now, in evolutionary terms, if you've been doing something for 3 million years, it's probably affected the evolution of the species. And there is evidence that, in fact, there are our brain is, in a sense, wired to use tools or to take advantage of tools. And indeed, if you think of, you know, think of what you do in the course of a day, and you use tools for many things. A number of you have a pen in their hands. A pen is a tool to write. In the 18th century, in the 1750s, Diderot and D'Alembert created this encyclopedia, which is a famous encyclopedia. What they did really was to go around France and make a record of all the tools they could find and then classify them. And you have pages of things like this. A very specialized tool. I mean, if you go to a woodworker workshop, you'll find, you know, plenty of tools that will all look the same to you, but are very different to him. It turns out that all these tools are still in use today. You know, novel technology have given us new tool. It's not necessarily killed the old ones. And so tools shape our environment. We use tools for drawing and writing, tools for cooking, tools for woodworking, tools for moving around. And a lot of our early life as kids and babies is spent mastering those tools. You know, remember how much time you learn to write? Learning to write is learning to master this object that is put in your hand to deposit ink on a piece of paper and forming phrases. And even though our hand is very very good at doing tiny movements, it takes time to master. Bicycle. You know, when you're a kid, you learn to bicycle first with either a tricycle or with the training wheels, because going to two wheels straight is too difficult. By the way, why do we have bikes with two wheels? If it's hard to learn, why don't we all ride bicycles? I'm sorry? I heard something.
You said, why do we all do bicycles instead of tricycles?
I say, why don't we all ride tricycles? Anyway, you get the...
You said bicycles, I'm just saying tricycles.
Okay.
So why don't we all use...
Tricycle. Yes.
Wheels. There you go.
Yes. Thank you. Someone is paying attention. So, what's why is it slower?
More
friction. Yeah.
It's also harder to turn unless you have a differential, but like on cars that you want.
So, why is it harder to turn? It's bigger. That's an advantage. The bike takes less room, but the tricycle is more stable. So, okay. Sorry.
Not flexible enough.
Flexible,
yeah.
In what way?
By turning, moving.
I don't know.
Yeah.
How much have you ridden a tricycle?
I don't 100% agree, because some people will ride tricycles. I mean, they coexist. It's not exclusively,
yeah.
Like, there are advantages of both of them.
Yeah. But, you know, if you sit there for an hour and you watch things going by, how many tricycles are you going to see? Okay. We were into something with the turning, just to get things moving here.
Can't do tricks. Can't do tricks. You know, like... Lifting.
You can do tricks, yes. Okay.
In the street, it's more difficult to
do
cars and
yeah. You know, I did that yesterday or last week with the first year students, and they found instantly. So I'm worried about you guys. Well, going fast, that was one hint. Turning, that was another hint. If you are on the tricycle and you try to take a fast turn, what's going to happen?
You're going to roll.
Yes, why?
Gyroscopic effect or something.
Yeah, centrifugal force. You turn, because you turn flat, and the centrifugal force is going to throw you out. What's happening with the bicycle? Yeah, you you counteract the centrifugal force by tilting the bike, and you can go very fast.
That's why you see motorcycles.
So, yeah. So the whole point of spending the time, energy, and pain to learn to ride a bicycle is so that you can go faster. Okay. I would really like to see the Tour de France on tricycle. I think that would be an interesting thing to watch. Anyway, my point was to say that tools are not always easy to learn, and yet we learn them because they really allow us to do things more efficiently or things that we're just unable to do without tools. Now, let's try to dig a little bit deeper in this and understand the underlying psychology. How many of you have heard of affordances and J.J. Gibson? Okay. So, Gibson is a psychologist who created the branch of psychology that is called ecological psychology. So ecological here, it's not that it's trying to be carbon neutral. It's not this kind of ecological. It's ecological in the sense that it's taking into account the animal, and we are animals, so humans are included, in their environment, and trying to better understand how the psychology of humans and animals has evolved with the environment. So he's studied visual perception a lot. This is his most famous book. And his take is that our visual system and our perceptual systems in general have evolved to pick up information from the environment. So his point is that our eyes are not little cameras that film the world, and then our brain is a kind of open CV program that does scene analysis. Our senses pick up directly information from the real world that is relevant to us. This picture here illustrates that with what is called the optical flow. If I move, or if I'm in a train that is moving, for example, I see things moving by me. So the things that are closer to the front are not moving as much as those that are right on the side of me. And the idea is that at any one time, I can know where I'm going by looking at the one point that doesn't move. And so that's what he calls an invariant. And there is now evidence that our visual system extracts this invariance. There are neurons that directly react to this kind of thing. So that's one aspect of his work. The reason is known in HCI is because he introduced the notion of affordance, which is essentially trying to think, okay, once we have this pickup capability, what happens when we act in the world and we want to do something? And so he introduced the notion of affordance, which is defined in his words, what the environment offers to the animal, what it provides or furnishes, either for good or ill. Now, when we hear about affordances in HCI, oftentimes it's not through Gibson, it's through another guy whose name is?
Norman.
Don Norman, our friend. Our friend Don. So Don Norman is a cognitive psychologist. I think he admitted himself that he never really understood what Gibson was talking about.
Because at UC San Diego, and Gibson came to visit for a sabbatical, and he learned about affordances, argued with him the whole time, and then ended up thinking later that it was kind of a useful idea, but but completely misrepresented it in his initial writing. He's sort of...
So now Don Norman explains that what he called affordances was really a mistake. It was not the affordances that Gibson was talking about. What Don Norman is talking about is what he called signifiers. And the difference is important because what Gibson is saying here is that the environment has capabilities for the animal or for the human. So in this room, there are chairs that offer sitability. They have the right size, the right resistance, so that a normal human body can sit on them, right? But it says nothing about whether you perceive those capabilities or not. They are just there, right? The affordances, as presented by Norman, that now we call signifiers, is to say that, well, an affordance is only good if you can actually perceive it. And so when we design novel systems, interactive or physical, we want to make these affordances perceivable by using some specific visual language or markers or something. And so that's a difference that is often lost when we use the word affordance in HCI. It's that the affordance is or is not there. And that's a separate question from whether you perceive it and therefore can take advantage of it. And both are important. A big issue in interactive system is what we call discoverability. How do you find what the system is able to do? Well, signifiers can help with that. The system has the capabilities, but if it doesn't show you or give you signs of how to do it, it's not useful. Now, interestingly... Oh, yeah, sorry. So... a number of experiments have been run to actually show the validity of the concept, and this is one paper among others, this one about space affordances, where you give this big round object to someone, and they will spontaneously discover its capabilities, such as rolling it, rolling on it, hiding inside of it, etc. Now, when you put the thing of direct perception through information pickup and the notion of affordances, we get to a notion that, in fact, was developed by his wife, Eleanor Gibson, who's, unfortunately, like too many women, lost to history. No, she's actually pretty famous. But in HCI, very few people have heard of Eleanor Gibson. Let's face it. And so she was interested in how children and babies learn. And the thing is, we spend a lot of our early life learning to see what is relevant in the environment. We learn to perceive affordances. So she's famous, among other things, for this experiment. She ran an experiment with toddlers, and she brought them in her lab, where she had built this thing where there is a table here with a checkered board. There is a piece of glass here, and then she would bring a mother and her baby, put the baby on this side of the table, the mother on the other side, and ask the mother to convince the baby to come to her. And the babies did not. And the reason is by this young age, I don't know if they were like 3 months old or, I mean, toddlers, right? Babies 3 months old. Toddlers is when they start
toddling.
By this age, they've already learned what she calls a visual cliff, that, you know, if you are on the edge of the table, you're going to fall. And so they have not learned that, well, there's these weird things called the glass that, you know, if it's thick enough, you can actually walk over. And in fact, you know, even if you get adults, in Toronto, there is a CN Tower. You know this huge tower? It's, I don't know, it's the size of the Eiffel Tower or something like this. And at the very top, there is this big observation deck. So we have a magnificent view, and there's a section with about 3 square meters of glass that is giving you a direct view to the ground 300 meters below. And it's amazing how people are reluctant to go on there, even though you know it's safe, So these are things we learn early on and that are very, that we don't even think about, of course, and are even very hard to fight. What I like about Eleanor Gibson is the saying that, we perceive to learn as well as we learn to perceive. And if you think of how people get to use interactive systems and computers, this is what we do. We have to perceive things to learn what they do, but we also learn what it is there is to perceive. So, for example, this plays tricks on us. I don't know how many of you use Macintosh. I see a number. Okay. So in the Macintosh, when you open a document, there is a title bar at the top. The title bar has the name of the document. Next to the document, there is a little icon of the document. Yes? It's the same icon that you have in the Finder that represents the file that you double-click to open the file. Now, if we had learned to perceive, we would make this connection and think, oh, an icon is there, so I could actually use it normally. Very few people know that if you actually click on that little icon in the title bar, you can then drag it and, for example, put it in email and attach it. How many of you, users of Macs, knew that? Okay. The others? No. Well, at least you learned that today. So, one difficulty in creating these artificial systems is that we have to create rules, we have to create conventions, and then we have to cross fingers that people will discover them. And in fact, we have software that is packed with features that we don't use because we don't even know they exist. So, how can we create systems that are more natural, I hate this word, but where users would more easily discover what they're capable of? And I would say that what we're trying to do with the principles we're going to present is to try to create more, in a sense, simple and unified principles that apply everywhere, so by learning less, you can still do more. Oh, here they are, James and Eleanor Gibson. So, yes, I'll skip this part since I talked about it, the signifiers that Norman later renamed instead of using affordances. And I'll get to the power of tools. So, coming back to tools, we internalize a tool as a physical extension of our body. There is work in neuroscience that actually shows evidence of this. I took this picture of this person here using a stick to presumably get, olives out of this tree. Because they made an experiment where you're sitting at a table and there are objects on the table at different distances. And you ask if you can reach for a particular object. But you cannot actually extend your arm to see if you are reaching or not. And that's one of the skills we learn. I don't have to calculate or try to know that from here there is actually nothing I can reach. But if I step here, I can easily reach your pen, but not your computer. So, this is an example of direct information pickup. Now, what's fascinating, I find, but say interesting, is that if you give me a stick, now instantly, I know that with the stick I can touch that computer without having to try. What's, I think, fascinating is that, in fact, we have neurons in our brain that react or fire or not fire, depending on whether my attention is focused on an object I can reach or I cannot reach. And when I get the stick in my hand, suddenly those neurons start firing for the objects I could not reach before, but I now can reach. And so that's what I mean by a physical extension of our body. It's suddenly as if my arm was longer. So I think this is a very powerful thing on which to base maybe some interface design. We are very good at appropriating tools. If you give a piece of chalk to a kid, you'll discover that, you know, walls are good surfaces to draw. And that's another interesting aspect of tools, is that we appropriate objects to use them as tools, and we create new uses spontaneously. Now, if we try to go further, trying to understand how we do these things of discovering new uses or simply using tools in the expected way, we can turn again to neuroscience. There's a French researcher, François Girac, who has this theory that he calls technical reasoning. If you want to know more about technical reasoning, Miguel here has read all the papers, and he knows more than me about it at this point. So Ozirak conducted experiments with patients that had apraxia. So apraxia is a series of mental disorders, either after an accident or where you become unable to do some types of actions. And so there are different forms. And one form is that you do not recognize what an object is for. And so by comparing how people would solve simple problems given set of objects to use as tools to solve that problem and see how people with and without apraxia were reacting gave him support for the hypothesis of technical reasoning. The thing is that when you use tools, there are several paths happening in your brain. If I need to cut a piece of bread, I know I need a knife. So this is learned, what's called procedural behavior. I don't need to innovate. If there is a knife there, I have a piece of bread, I go for it. But if I don't have a knife, then I have to go into another mode. I have to figure out, well, how am I going to do this? So I need something that has these properties, has to be sharp and thin and this, etc. And so this is what he called technical reasoning. It's that when faced a problem for which we don't have a learned procedure, we try to see in the objects at hand if there are objects with the right properties to solve our problem. And so we do this with physical objects. You know, if I need to prop the door open, but there's nothing to block it, I'm going to look around and say, oh, well, there's a chair here. Chair is sort of big enough to block the door, so I'm going to appropriate the chair to prop the door open. We do this all the time. With software, though, we don't do it so much all the time, because software, we've learned, is kind of rigid. It does the thing it was designed for and not much more. However, I'm sure, and do we have an exercise on this? I think we have an exercise on how, you know, we invent or appropriate digital tools. So here are two very simple objects, a pen and a mug. And if you see them, you've learned to recognize them as a pen and as a mug. A pen to write, a mug to drink coffee. But it's very easy to imagine a context where you would use the pen as a ruler to draw a straight line or the mug as a quick way to draw a circle. And when you do this, you're not looking at the mug as a mug anymore. You're looking at it as, oh, it's an object, and it has a circular shape, and I'm looking for something to do a circle, so it matches, and so I'm going to just put two and two together and use it like this. And so that's what we want to have in digital tools. More flexibility to appropriate tools, to maybe use objects that were not tools as tools, and make environments where there is more flexibility from the users. Of course, there's a danger with that, is that we may have too many tools. I think it's a good problem to have. You know, in the real world, if you go into a store for art, for example, you have hundreds of different types of pens and brushes and things, and it doesn't seem to be a big problem for people to decide which one to use. François Augirac has an interesting theory, or having studied the use of tools very much, he's at the point where he thinks that humans sort of overemphasize or overestimate the power of tools, and they tend to create tools just for the sake of creating tools, even if the situation doesn't really require it. But again, you know, that's not, I think, a critical problem for what we're trying to do. So what about digital tools? Well, we've been creating digital tools for a long time. This is, by the way, how long do you want me to talk here?
Until the break, and then I need an hour.
Okay, so the break is in another half hour. Yes.
Break at 3?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll try to do 20 minutes. So, as early as 1963, here, Evan Sutherland created Sketchpad. You've heard of this before? Yes? So, Sketchpad was, I don't know if I showed the video or maybe you can see it offline. Yeah, okay. So this is the computer. It was a personal computer at the time, the only personal computer on Earth, as far as I can tell. 1963, yes. So he has a light pen and buttons on the side, and he can directly draw a shape. Then he's pointing at all these segments, clicking that button on the right and the left, and say, I want these to be orthogonal to each other. And the system is going to actually do a constraint solving to make it orthogonal. Then you can zoom in real time. Even Photoshop cannot do that today. Then you're going to draw two other lines, and these are going to represent a hole in that mechanical piece. He asks them to make them parallel, and the system adjusts that. Then he's going to turn that into a dash pattern. I really love the way he's doing this, you know, his gestures. You feel like he's living the thing. And so we have bimanual interaction, you know, pointing with the right hand, clicking buttons with the left hand. And here is deleting, so the half of the lines, is zooming back. And I'm going to skip, and I encourage you to watch the rest of the... So here is created now a rivet. So he's made this shape. He was able to create the circle by saying the center is here and it has to go through these two points. And again, the system adjusts to satisfy the constraint is specified to have square angles. And after that, it can readjust the size because it's not the size he wants. And the system remembers the constraints that were there before, solves the constraints. Then he can take this rivet, makes multiple copies, and then assemble them with the other piece that he was building before. So in 1963, Susan Evan Sutherland invented, you know, the modern graphical user interface. It had direct manipulation. It had things that only advanced systems offer today, like this constraint solving in real time. And direct manipulation of objects, as we see here. So we... Okay, what's happening? I want to go back here. Preview. Where did it go? That's interesting. Oh. No, it was the PDF version. Okay, it's there, back there. So we've been dealing with tools with computers for a long time. As I said, you know, a tool is like a bicycle for the mind. But there's still a big difference, in my opinion. When you see a graphic designer here working, you can see his desk. He has a bunch of things. He has papers. He has various tools. He has the famous coffee mug, etc. And when you look at him working, you know, it can fluidly change from one tool to the next. You may hold a pen while holding something else at the same time. So there's this kind of fluid interactions. But when I'm trying to do something like this very slide, I have this clunky Windows stuck in front of the content I'm trying to manipulate. And I'm trapped inside an application that has decided once and for all, and without asking me, that, you know, while to select a color, you're going to have to use this wheel. To control text, it's going to be this dialog box. And if I move to another application, well, it's going to be the same thing, but not the same thing. And so computers teach me not to learn anything, because, and especially nowadays, where not only there are upgrades all the time, they are pushed to you without you having to do anything. And so overnight, your software can change. And something you knew to do yesterday is not valid anymore.
Can I just ask a pop quiz question? So, is this an example of recognition or recall?
What stuff?
The dialog box there. Point to a dialog box.
Like this one?
Yeah.
Recognition or recall? Ta-da!
Recognition.
I have one recognition here. Okay. Yes. Oh, now everybody says yes.
If I made you type out the RGB color code, what would that be? Recall. Exactly. Some people can do.
Okay. Which gets us to really the point of the lecture today: instrumental interaction. You probably learned in your first year that graphical user interfaces are sort of defined by the concept of direct manipulation. Yes? You've heard of the term direct manipulation?
Just a show of hands. Direct manipulation,
yes.
Yes. Okay, right.
Okay, that's... Now, when you hear the term direct manipulation, it feels like, well, you know, I'm directly manipulating the things on the screen, which, of course, you never do because... You either have a mouse or a trackpad, and even if you're doing direct touch, it's still, you know, you're touching a flat piece of glass, not really the objects. But even if you omit this business of the input device, in many interfaces, and there was an example in this one, there are some things that I would say are rather direct. I can, you know, for example, move the image or resize it. But everything else, and the reason why there are all these dialog boxes is to me to make the interaction indirect. If I want to change the color of something, I cannot do it on the something. I have to go through this panel. So,
can I just really highlight that? Because it's not like there are times when you try to figure, should I really pay attention to this point? That point's really important.
Now,
the idea that
Now, he used the term direct manipulation by contrast with the dominant interfaces at the time, which were command line interfaces, right? Where you needed to know, and that was another recognition versus recall, you needed to know the names of things. So naming things is an indirect way of referring to things. With direct manipulation, the things are on the screen, you want to talk about them, you click at them. However, over the years, to create more and more powerful systems, we've created all these intermediates between me, the user, and the things I want to manipulate. So when I have this color wheel, I mean, indeed, I'm directly manipulating this wheel by clicking on it or by sliding the slider here. But that's not what I'm interested in the first place. What I'm interested in is how the color is going to look in the target objects and in the context of that object. So if direct manipulation is a lie, as Wendy said, what if we made it explicit that interaction can be indirect? And what if we made it explicit that we have tools to support this indirection? Because after all, when you're writing on paper, you don't write bare hands, you're using a pen. So if we're used to using tools to mediate our interaction in the physical world, why don't have tools in the digital world? So an example of a tool that was created for the digital world is the scroll bar. Have you ever seen a physical scroll bar? Okay, that's pretty close, good one. but I've never seen a scroll bar to flip through a book, right? So we invented the scroll bar to solve a problem we had with computers where the content was larger than the window through which we display it, and we need to access the hidden parts. Okay, we came up with that thing, and I call the scroll bar a tool or an instrument. It solves a problem, which is accessing hidden parts of an object by showing me, in a sense, a representation of the object with the thumb, etc. You know how a scroll bar works. But the point here is that it breaks interaction into two steps, because they happen simultaneously, but into two levels. I am interacting with the mouse, which controls the scroll bar, and that thing then controls the document, which is going up and down, which is really what I'm interested in. And in fact, when I scroll a scroll bar, I usually don't look at the scroll bar, which is actually a source of problems, because typically your cursor starts shifting away from the scroll bar, and so at some point it decides to not scroll anymore because you're too far away from the scroll bar. Because the designers didn't realize that when you use a scroll bar, you're not interested in the scroll bar, you're interested in the document you're scrolling. So this idea of taking a look at even existing interfaces, not even thinking of creating new ones, but looking at existing interfaces with this lens of, can I see things that are tools in current interfaces? Is a first step in trying to sort of change our perspective on how we want to design new interfaces. So what we've shown is that instrumental interaction is this model of thinking of digital tools, digital instruments that mediate interaction, applies to direct manipulation interfaces. It applies to other types of interactions, and in particular tangible interactions. There's a class on tangible interaction that maybe you'll take in the second trimester, and a lot of the things they present there are actually making physical tools for interacting with digital content. Now, at the same time, it doesn't cover every type of interaction. Voice-based interactions, when you talk to Siri or Alexa, it's not instrumental. We've shifted from first-person interface to second-person interface, and that's a different world. And that's fine. We don't need to do everything with this. Gesture-based interaction is an interesting case, because when you're gesturing, we don't know. And I think there are cases where it will have an instrumental aspect to it, and some where it's more similar to verbal communication, where you have to have learned very specific gestures the same way you learn words, or you learn ideograms or different vocabularies. So in 20 years ago, we both were in Denmark at the University of Aarhus, and we were given an opportunity to actually apply these ideas to completely redesign a tool for editing PetriNets. PetriNets are these things that are made of different types of boxes connected together with arrows, and these describe, in fact, programs. Don't need to go into details. What was interesting is that it has this graphical formalism, and we were, you know, given carte blanche, as they say in French, so we could redesign interface in whichever way we wanted, and in the end, they decided if they liked it or not. It seems like they liked it, because now CPN 2000 has become CPN Tools, and is distributed worldwide, and every person in the world who uses PetriNet, which arguably is not maybe that many people, but certainly all of them use or at least know of CPN tools. I'm not going to go into the details of what we did in that particular example. I want to show you one thing we worked on and that 15 years later continued with a new project to illustrate one of the principles that we've come up with, which is the critical, the most important one, called reification. Remember the scroll bar. It's an object that you can interact with that actually embodies a rather abstract command, which is navigate. I mean, navigate is a very vague thing. But it's being turned into, attempted to say, physical object, at least, an interface object that you can directly manipulate. That's reification. In a lot of the interfaces we use today, you have all these commands in menus. You have all these icons. And a lot of them, they are just words. And the interaction that you have with them is not very intuitive. You have to have selected the right thing in the right order and then click that thing, and then you have a dialog box and you have to specify additional options, and then you say OK and something happens. This is not instrumental. This is not direct manipulation. This is lousy design. So what if we think of things we do quite regularly that we could reify into more intuitive objects? So that's what we did with alignment. I'm sure you're all familiar with this type of dialog box when you are in, I don't know, PowerPoint or Illustrator, graphic design tool, where you put shapes and then you want to align them. And what you expect it to do is to select them, go into the menu or into a toolbar of sorts, and select one of these things. And then all the objects get aligned. Interestingly, people usually don't know which one is used as a reference. Is it the first one? Is it the... I don't know. And it changes from system to system. Me, I don't know if I'm dyslexic, but I always end up with the things stacked on top of each other instead of being aligned because I clicked the wrong button. And then, of course, you make changes, and the system does not remember that you wanted these things to get aligned, so you reselect them and you realign them. Sound familiar? Yes? Okay. Well, what if we reify the alignment command into what we call a guideline, into an object that is on the screen that you can manipulate, and all I want to do is be able to drag an object to it, drag it away from it, and maybe take the line, move the line, and what should happen? The objects stay attached. How hard is that?
Simplicity.
Well, this is what we did with this system called Sticky Lines. And does it start? Okay, I'm going to go Okay, here we go. So you create a line, you drag objects to them, they snap, then you move the line, the objects move. Yeah. Then you can say, well, I want to distribute objects. So if I remove or add an object, they redistribute themselves. I can distribute from the left, from the right, from the middle, whatever. I can create an horizontal line that will automatically grab everything that's on it. Then I can create a vertical one. I can align to the left of the objects here, not necessarily the center. And I can also move the line and attach object as I go. The system can provide feed forward of possible alignments, and if I leave the objects there, it creates the sticky line all for me. Did you follow that?
Right.
I've shown this video so many times that I have the pace, but it is very fast.
Something about it with respect to simplicity and power of expression, right? Before you have your pull down menu, you slide, maybe it's a hierarchical menu, you go there and there and there and you find it and you click it and then it's done. That's simple. It's recall. I can get it. I you know, I can recognize that that's alignment. But it's not powerful. Here what we have is the same amount of simplicity of interaction. All I have to do is put that little round object on that line. It's actually easier than going out, you know, getting the right point in a pull-down menu. And now I have this tremendous amount of power because alignments and constraints are maintained in a really powerful way. So when you watch, these things are being grabbed by the line is doing things for me. So it's a very powerful tool that has the same or better simplicity and way more power.
Yes.
Like she said.
Well, more simplicity, you've seen that once, you know how to use it.
Which is really true.
And we've really tested that. And more power because it can maintain alignment over time. Whereas traditional approaches, you line at some point in time and then the system forgets about it.
There's another interesting thing which is hidden in there, but it's this notion of distribution.
So, yeah, that's...
The distribution and alignment are linked to each other, and you get distribution practically for free.
So here, there was a little menu here where you can say, well, I want this line to be a distribution line, not just alignment, but also distribution. So immediately, it made the objects equally spaced. And in the next segment, when you pull out the blue objects, the other three redistribute. And if you put it back, they realign. They redistribute again. And then you can have different reference points for the distribution. So here the idea is that so you can have things align both horizontally and vertically. And here it's the idea that you can pick up objects as you go. And this one... So this one doesn't stop in the right place. So this one shows the feed forward, these two dotted lines, to tell you, oh, there's an element here. And many tools do this today. They help you by snapping to existing alignments. But here, it creates the lines. So that after you've done that, you can manipulate the lines directly and adjust your layout. Now, we developed and tested that tool with graphic designers, and they told us, well, you know, this is all nice and good, but in practice, when I work with logos or irregular shapes, they are not, the alignment around the center or even the side is not the proper visual alignment I'm looking for. And so we've seen graphic designers, they use the alignment command for the coarse alignment, and then they tweak it. Well, reification again. Let's reify the tweak. So here, he wants to align this object that has this bigger bounding box. So he's pushing the arrow key downwards. Say, I want to adjust it. And the system creates this little purple line here, which reifies the adjustment that has been made. And so then when you move this other, and so it's stays attached. When it moves the other, of course, you want to do the same thing, but we have the tweak that you can copy and paste. Now, the object, the tweak is attached to the object, so it moves with it, and I can then get rid of it. I can also tweak the bounding box. Here, I'm tweaking the bounding box for this object, because I care about the circle, not the tail of it, I can copy and paste this adjusted bounding box, adjust it to this other object, and when I distribute objects, it's that adjusted bounding box that is going to be taken into account as the size of the object, so that here, when I change, when I tweak the bounding box, the rest of the objects, as you saw, distribute themselves accordingly. Now, once you start aligning around lines, what not around circles, what about aligning around existing objects? So we have a circle object, but we align around it. What about aligning around arbitrary lines? And here is what about playing with the distribution itself? Because when we say distribute, we imply distribute equally. Well, what if I want to distribute in an exponential way or in a... And so here we have this curve that maps the source objects to their position. So here they are more close together on the sides than in the middle, but in a way that I control. And so we ran experiments, and it works, and people like it, and Adobe should pay us millions to put in their software, but they haven't done so yet. And but you know what? Even if they steal it, that would be fine with me. So there is something weird that I have to do to get back to the slides that I just don't get. This is Wendy's desktop. I'm sorry, Wendy. This is a piece of art. She's worked hard for it. Okay, so we have reification. The idea is we try to turn abstract concepts into concrete things that the user can manipulate. And once you've done that, well, you have these objects, so you can copy and paste them and duplicate them and start playing with them in interesting ways. What we found is the other way to complement reification is to also have another property called polymorphism. Making it so a tool or an object can be used in different contexts and not just for one thing. So one of the examples we like to take is the color selector. There are many pieces of software where you need to specify a color. And each piece of software comes with its own color selector. And if I'm used to, say, Photoshop, that's using this one, among others, and then I go to Excel or Microsoft, then I'm stuck with one of those. Now, why on earth can't I take this one and use it in a spreadsheet or a text document? All these things do in the end is specify an RGB color, right? What if I had this physical device here, which you can buy on the internet? Actually, I haven't found it, so I'm starting to doubt that it exists. But on my iPhone, I have an app that does exactly that. That uses the camera, I can go and pick a color. But then to transfer that color to, you know, my slide-making software, I either have to list the RGB code and retype it or do something crazy. Yes. So we want to break applications and make it so you can have tools that are, in a sense, separate from the objects they are designed to manipulate, so that then I can go and get this or that tool as a developer. Maybe I can create new ones and sell them on the tool store instead of an app store, and completely change, in a sense, the economic model for this type of software, which has been to sell you big monolithic software that is entirely controlled by the company selling it. And it's actually interesting to see that, you know, they're transitioning from a model where you would buy software and you would have it, and you would pay for upgrades every once in a while. But they realize they're not making enough money from that, so they want now to have you subscribe to it. So you pay again and again and again for having features thrown at you that you didn't ask for, and no really control on what you work with. So it's like, imagine, to me, it's like living in a hotel instead of living at home. I don't know many people who like living in a hotel. It sounds fine for a while, but... So I don't know if the analogy works, but it works for me. Last principle for today, reuse. We observed people doing PetriNets, graphic designers, other types of users. We observed ourselves. We rarely create things from scratch. We like to start from something else and tweak it, modify it. Sometimes in the end, you've removed everything that was there and you recreated completely the new things, but you didn't start from nothing. I usually tell the story that when I write a recommendation letter for a student, I always start from the last one I wrote, and I try to remember to change the name in the right places. And sometimes I rewrite the thing and it has nothing to do with it, but it put me in the context of writing a recommendation letter. There are very few techniques for reuse. There is, like, you know, copy-paste, duplicate, I mean, all the things we know, but it's kind of limited. What we've identified is there's two types of reuse. There is what we call output reuse and input reuse. Output reuse is that when you take the objects that have been generated by the system or that you have created yourselves, and you reuse those, for example, by making copies. But there's also input reuse, where what you want to reuse is not the object itself, it's not the output, it's the series of commands that you used to manipulate existing objects. So redo is a very crude example. Macros are more sophisticated. Macros are usually hard to use in current software. But that's very powerful because, you know, I went from that object to this one by saying, well, I want to rotate it and make its color darker, and then I can apply this series of commands again and then get that third object, and in a sense have a generative way of creating new objects. And we think that if systems supported more forms of both output and input reuse, you would get a lot of power out of it. To finish about instrumental interaction, so everything we've shown so far is in the context of graphical user interfaces on the desktop computer, right? But tools are also, I mentioned briefly, tangible interaction. Tools become interesting when you start thinking about how they could play out in the world we are today, where we have a laptop, I have a smartphone, I have a second one recording my speech, I have a tablet there, you guys have computers all over the place. We have all these devices, and they essentially ignore each other. And personally, every time I need to transfer things from one to the other, I struggle. Now, with colleagues from Denmark, we worked on different systems where those devices are used as instruments interacting with the contents you bring them to. So we had this, this is dated because this is a Nokia something-something pre-iPhone, where we had a wall display, a projected screen, and a drawing program that we could draw on the display, and that device was used to pick colors or to you had the interface in your hand. And the idea is that, you know, I can take this to a different type of program on the screen and still have access to, say, color selection. This was another one to play a game of Othello or Reversi. And so I think this notion of mediated interaction through instruments has interesting potential for not only graphical user interfaces, but also Ubicomp, maybe virtual reality, or augmented reality, and tangible interaction, as I mentioned. So I think I'm done. Here we were going to do some kind of a little bit of a... Oh, it's 3 o'clock, so
right on time.
I think the idea, well, usually in the second part of the session we do exercises related to that, but today you have to do this other thing.
Right.
And so next time we'll do the... you'll be doing the work.
Well, yeah, it gets more interactive.
Yeah.
We will...
We needed to seed some content.
Yeah, in the
content.
Beginning part we talk a lot, and as the thing goes over, you talk more and more and do stuff more. So we're going to give you a break. Do you have your watch?
It's 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. So back here at 3:15, I do need you for the whole hour and 15 minutes that's left after that, because we're going to be doing teaching how to do the first really important exercise for the HCI boot camp.